So good afternoon and welcome to another episode of Read Me Something You Love.
Hi Steve.
And I'm sitting here with Anoush Sherman today, and Anoush is a writer and translator. We've just had a lovely cup of tea in your kitchen, and sitting in front of some beautifully stocked bookshelves, and Anoush, you being multilingual in a way that makes me quite jealous. there's three languages on this bookshelf. I'm very struck by the fact that you've got, you know, that there's a stark contrast between the French spines, you know, those Gallimard, the white. So that you get four shelves of just kind of white, and then you get all of this sort of colour in the English spines. I was very struck by that. Spine wise, what do you enjoy looking at more? Because there is a difference, isn't there?
Oh, it's a really good question. Definitely the colourful. Also, the French side is quite organised, and whereas all the English colourful one is. Only I can find the books here, you know, because they're really organized in the chronological order in which I read them. So if I'm looking for something that I read maybe 5 years ago, I know it will be at the top. Actually, it doesn't go all the way to the present because it's now the present time have moved to another bookshelf. So it sort of stops about 2 years ago.
That's an amazing way to organize. I've never heard of that before, and it just makes so much sense. So if I'm looking at your bookshelf, I don't know when, but at a certain period of time, you had a massive Isaac Bashevis Singer splurge.
Yes.
And then that went to Primo Levi, and then to Beckett, and then to Paul Muldoon. Is that literally yours?
Not quite literally.
The journey, almost?
It wasn't quite the journey, but these were things that I read maybe 5-6 years ago. And indeed, you know, I went through a big Bashevis Singer phase. I read the whole of Bashevis Singer and then the whole of Primo Levi. I think I actually read Primo Levi before I read Bashevis Singer. But
Then you need to redistribute those books, yeah?
Yes,
because you've got at the moment Primo is coming after Isaac.
That's right. But sort of more or less, you know, sort of time scale. It's like a timeline, you know?
Yeah. Well, great. And today we're going to have a very... the word sexy came to mind. There's something about being multilingual that's kind of sexy. Very sexy multilingual podcast because we're going to hear a poem by Apollinaire, and you are going to give us the poem in one of your mother tongues. I don't know, would you say French is your mother tongue?
Yes, definitely.
Because you speak Hebrew as well,
don't you? Yes, Hebrew is my second language.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, but I learned Hebrew when I was seven.
Yeah, so it's... Almost a mother tongue, father tongue, and then your own translation, which is quite special. Your own translation of this poem. So Apollinaire, I'm imagining you. Apollinaire is something that all French children are sort of drummed into them at school. Is it? Is that where you discovered him, or?
No, I discovered him actually when I was a student, and I lived in my brother's flat, and my brother had an amazing library even back then. He was just a few years older than me, but he had an amazing library, and I just started reading his books. Now, I'd heard of Apollinaire before and stuff, but, you know, I never really read him, and I just fell in love with Apollinaire, you know, it's just so, yeah.
What is it about Apollinaire that you love about his work?
His poetry always spoke to me, you know. It's difficult to explain why you love something.
It's a very visceral sort of...
Yes, you just relate to it. You
yes.
just... Apollinaire's very visual as well. And I always felt that, you know, a little bit like with the story, you know, I was there. And I could relate to you know, the sort of poetic landscape. It's like a trip, you know. I think the journey evolves in this poem in quite a sort of subterranean way. it's not obvious, you know. I mean, he's not traveling from one place to another. It's not chronological. He is, you know, there is no process. You know, this is a poem about loss, really, and about, you know, but there's no process. He's not starting off the poem by, you know, he's not feeling better at the end of the poem. He's feeling just as bad as in the beginning. So, you know, I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, absolutely. And certain people are going to be kind of perked up by that and say, ah, oh, thank goodness, because that will mirror their own hopes and aspirations and sense of how the world works, and other people will be switching off straight away when they hear that. But it sounds fantastic to me. I think we should get straight into the journey.
Okay.
So you're going to read it for us in French first.
Yes.
Great. I'm looking forward to that.
Okay. Le pont Mirabeau. Sous le pont Mirabeau coule la Seine et nos amours. Faut-il qu'ils m'en souviennent? La joie venait toujours après la peine. Vienne la nuit. Sonne l'heure, les jours s'en vont, je demeure. Les mains dans les mains, restons face à face, tandis que sous le pont de nos bras passent des éternels regards, l'onde s'y lasse. Vienne la nuit, sonne l'heure, les jours s'en vont, je demeure. L'amour s'en va comme cette eau courante, l'amour s'en va comme la vie est lente et comme l'espérance est violente. Vienne la nuit, sonne l'heure, les jours s'en vont, je demeure. Passent les jours et passent les semaines, ni temps passé, ni les amours reviennent. Sous le pont Mirabeau coule la Seine. Vienne la nuit, sonne l'heure, les jours s'en vont, je demeure.
Thank you. So you really, I mean, even if my French isn't great, but you know that you really hear the rhythms and the undulations of the Seine and of the bell ringing as well, don't you?
Yes, I mean it's a very very musical poem. You know, there's a lot of music, and it's the beauty of the poem is that it's not obvious. You know, the in the sense that the rhyming, you know. But it is, indeed, you know, it's supposed to be like the water flows under the bridge. It's very melancholical, I must say. I mean,
you can hear that just in the music,
yes,
of the words,
that's
can't
right.
you?
I should have said it before, melancholia was his big subject. Yeah. You know, he was a melancholiac. And yes, there's a lot of melancholia. Mm. And
so let's hear your translation.
Okay, well, in my translation, I tried to keep the rhythm and the music because it's so important in poetry, you know. Under the Mirabeau Bridge flows the Seine and our love. Must I recall, joy always came after sorrow. Night falls, the hour calls, days go by, I remain. Hand in hand, let us stay face to face, while under the bridge of our arms pass eternal looks, the current so drained. Night falls, the hour calls, days go by, I remain. Love is going as these running waters, love is going, how slow is life, and hopefulness intense. Night falls, the hour calls, days go by, I remain. Days pass and weeks pass, neither past times no, our love comes back. Under the Mirabeau Bridge flows the Seine. Night falls, the hour calls, days go by, I remain.
Is there some kind of narrative here for you?
For me, there's a very, very clear story. I mean, there is something which is like a poetic landscape, which, you know, Apollinaire is part of. And, you know, this is a poem about someone who's, you know, stands on the bridge, and obviously he's very sad. It's a very sad poem.
Because
love is lost, because, you know, he's facing up to the loss, to something which is lost. And sonne l'heure, you know, it's an imagery for saying, you know, when suddenly you are realizing something, or you know, and what he's realizing, of course, is that, you know, love is gone and it's not going to come back. And and days go by and I remain, and a lot of these things which, you know, are difficult to come to terms with. And the poetic journey that he is part of, because you ask me, I mean, a lot of poems are like a walk, you know, you walk. I mean, Goethe also wrote a lot when he walked, you know, it's all about a walk. And I imagine that, you know, he has a broken heart, and Apollinaire had his heart broken many times. He was real, you know, got into trouble lots and lots of times with women. And so he's walking through Paris, you know, thinking about some failed love affair, if you like. And as he walks, he's thinking about a very well-known French poem that everyone knows, which is Paul Verlaine, Chanson d'automne. And in that poem, there is, I mean, I can recite it for you, but it's the hour also calls. And so he's thinking, you know, like in this Verlaine Chanson d'automne, autumn song, which is also about loss and you know, and being like a dead leaf, or like an autumn leaf in the wind, you know, feeling completely lost because you are dealing with loss.
So it's a sort of homage also to that.
That's right.
But it's also, I suppose, a homage to, in the sense, a sort of an empathy, an inclusion, realization perhaps that others have lost before, that Verlaine has lost and I am lost and we're all lost in some sort of flowing Seine-like way.
Yes, but the journey carries on, you know, so he walks, and as he walks he thinks of Verlaine's poem, and then he gets to a bridge. And when he gets to the bridge, then his own thing comes out. So,
and what is his own thing?
Apollinaire's own thing. Well, he's, you know, he's obviously trying to come to terms with some, you know, failed love affair. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what it's all about, you know. And it's very difficult for him. And obviously it's, you know, pretty tragic because he may be considering jumping into the Seine.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Of course. And, you know, the idea that days go by, I remain, is not a cheerful idea. It's something that sometimes you feel when you don't want to remain. You know, you're thinking, you know, I wish I didn't have to survive this. It's maybe the hardship of being a survivor as well. You know, I mean, people who go through terrible trauma. Okay, he was a great romantic, Apollinaire. So, you know, when he had a failed love affair, it was the end of the world, you know.
Well, as it is for most of us.
As
let's
it
face
is for
it, you know.
Exactly. When absolutely. And there's no age. All ages are valid, you know. And absolutely. And, you know, being a melancholic and being very, very melancholic and this. And in a way, you know, he doesn't want to live past. The love is gone. And he doesn't want to live past it, you know.
It's interesting that you read that Days Go By, I Remain as a sort of a falling exclamation of sorts. Because you could equally, particularly when it's followed by, from a line after a line, joy always came after sorrow, you could also read it positively. You could read it, couldn't you, that Days go by, experience like the river passes through us, but I remain, something essential, something that is not transient, although of course this is the irony that we too are transient, the I is also transient, but there is for this moment on this bridge an I that is less transient than the river.
I think that when he says joy always came after sorrow, it's actually something which he's struggling with, because in a way he is so heartbroken, he doesn't want joy to come after sorrow. He wants to stay with that sorrow.
Is that why he says, must I recall joy always came after
sorrow?
That's right. He's almost resentful that there might be some cheerful sort of come on,
exactly,
pull your socks up person saying joy always came after sorrow.
Exactly.
Right.
So, you know, if we just stipulate like this, it's as if he's saying, I don't want another love. I want that one, or nothing, or else I may jump into the river.
Yeah.
I don't want to feel better. Mm. I don't want to write a love poem for someone else. I don't I am struggling now in this moment with this particular loss. We don't know if it was the love of his life, was just like they say in French, une amourette, something very short, or if it was, you know, this is how he feels now. He feels that, you know, he doesn't want to move on. This is the opposite of moving on. And he is rebelling against the idea of moving on. And what the water is doing is that the metaphor, the image of the river Seine flowing under the bridge, water
moves.
Exactly, travels. Yeah. So, you know, life, nature is telling you, move on. You're going to move on.
And the bridge says, I don't move. I stay here.
Yeah, and he says, I don't want to.
Yeah.
I don't want to. I don't want to feel better.
Uh-huh.
And
there is something glorious about that as well, that kind of wallowing in, I mean, maybe again, it is just a personality trait. You know, some people, for example, can't stand those artists who seem to wallow in melancholia. I'm thinking pop artists, I'm thinking people like, you know, I don't know, Morrissey or Leonard Cohen or all of these kinds of people. And of course, other people revel in that kind of wallowing.
People are discouraged from wallowing. It's not considered politically correct, you know? It's considered self-indulgent, and it's considered as something which goes against what our modern society, especially Anglo-Saxon, I must say. In France, it's very different. Times pass them by. You can wallow as much as you want in Paris. It's completely acceptable. On the contrary, you'd be weird if you didn't. Uh-huh. But there's a huge difference between Francophone and Anglo-Saxon society. And here, you know, it's get over it, you know, get over things, move on.
Life Plenty is more calling. Fish in the sea,
yeah,
all
exactly.
of that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so rather than the hour calls, it would be life is calling, the job is calling, your obligations are calling.
So what is the out? What does that? What do you think that means for this wallowing man on the bridge? The hour calls. What does that mean? What does that mean to him? The hour calls.
That is a moment of realization. You know, this Mirabeau bridge is. This is one moment, if you like, in metaphorically speaking, as an image. I don't mean that it happens in a minute, in one moment, but it's that sort of moment. Which, of course, he writes it down as a whole experience, where you are realizing something, you are realizing the loss, and you are struggling against it. You don't want to, you know. This is the opposite of what people are trying to do in everyday life nowadays, which is they are trying to overcome things, they are trying to get over things, they are trying to move on, they are trying to be, productive. This is unproductive. This is this moment when he realizes that he realizes the loss, and he says, I don't want to. I don't want to accept it. You know, so much of our modern life is about accepting. We have to accept things. And this is, he says, no, I don't want to accept. I don't want to accept that life is like flowing water, that eventually I will feel better. Eventually joy will come back. I don't want it. I want to stay in that moment where I am realizing that. And I think that one of the ways you could define melancholia is you could say when loss is forever, which is, of course, a contradiction. You know, the sense that, you know, loss is, that something which is lost will be lost forever. And that's melancholia. And I think this is what he's talking about. So the hour call, he really is realizing, you know, not coming to terms, but or thinking about it, which of course is very French, you know, you think.
And feeling it, feeling that.
Yes.
I mean, that line, you know, how slow is life and hopefulness intense.
Yes.
So, of course, the acceptance would be, but that's also an acceptance. There is an acceptance going on here, isn't there? There's the acceptance of the pain and the intensity of our desires, because hopefulness is a desire.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then that intensity of hopefulness, you know, this is romantic movement. This is romanticism, you know.
Mm.
And I don't think he means intense as in sort of violent or anything like that, but it's more the intensity of feeling. You know, it is so condensed. It is so... you know, this in this that little hope contains everything. Mm. Because it is as if his life depends on it. Mm. You know, this is a... So...
I mean, just hearing you speak, it makes me think that perhaps this is also the difference between melancholia and what we would call kind of depression. I mean, people would say that depression is a kind of, you know, we used to call it melancholia. It's a sort of the new melancholia. But of course, when you're depressed, even moderately so, there isn't much hopefulness. In fact, you know you're depressed when things feel pretty hopeless and there's no hopefulness. Mm-hmm. So it's just suffering and there's no hopefulness. And I find it quite interesting here that although he is suffering, he uses this word hopefulness intense rather than hopelessness intense. Mm-hmm.
Yes, because I think that that's a huge part of you know, the whole atmosphere, the whole picture he's drawing and his whole state of mind. And the... In a way, you know, there's a lot of ambiguity. This hopefulness is intense in the sense that he doesn't want to accept the loss. That's also a type of hopefulness, you know. I hope that I will that maybe the loss is not final, that maybe something will change. He's not so much the hopefulness doesn't relate so much to joy always comes after sorrow. That is given. That is nature. And in a way, he is rebelling against it. He's being a rebel. The hopefulness he feels is the hopefulness that perhaps actually the loss is not final. You know, and he's struggling with that. And, you know, I mean, melancholia, you know, even sort of according to Freud, it's like never the mourning process, never concluding. It's forever mourning. You know how there are all these stages of mourning. Whether you're mourning at someone who died or someone you lost or whatever, it's the same process. Mm-hmm. And someone who's melancholic is someone whom the process is just endless. It's just never accepting. It's about acceptance. Mm-hmm. And
is that maybe also, when you were saying that, I suddenly thought, well, maybe also a poem, in a way, can be a space for that in our lives, in the sense that, of course, this place where he's at, we can revisit that.
Absolutely.
Again and again and again and again, and we don't have to resolve it in the poem.
Absolutely. Absolutely, exactly. And, you know, I think, you know, this poem probably gave a platform or, you know, millions of people, hopefully, to indeed, you know, be in that moment because they can relate to that moment in their own life, and it's, yes, it's a platform that you can always revisit.
And what about for you, coming back to this poem again and again over the years, has your relationship with the poem changed?
Yes, I think that the first time I read it, which was a very, very long time ago, you know, I mean, when I was young.
Still young?
I misunderstood it, like you often do with very simple poetry.
And, so what did you think it was about?
Well, I knew it was about a man who stands on the bridge and he's heartbroken, but I didn't understand, you know, all these sort of the undercurrent of the poem, because the undercurrent is only something you understand, of course, with life experience. You know, you, if you like, you understand the intensity, you know, and... that intensity that he speaks about. I mean, of course, if you read it very young and you haven't had much life experience, it's never going to be that intense. But the intensity is made, the fabric of intensity is the experience, the life experience you've had.
Well, thank you so much for introducing me to the poem and for reading it to me in your beautiful translation and the beautiful original as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks. Thank you. It's been great. Pleasure.